Chapter 16. Resisting Situational Influences and Celebrating Heroism. Caring, Kindness, Cooperation, and Love. Much of our time was spent in the simulated prison that my colleagues and I created in the basement of Stanford University's psychology department. In just a few days and nights, the virtual paradise that is Palo Alto, California, and Stanford University became a hellhole. Healthy young men developed pathological symptoms that reflected the extreme stress, frustration, and hopelessness they were experiencing as prisoners. Their counterparts, randomly assigned to the role of guards, repeatedly crossed the line from frivolously playing that role to seriously abusing their prisoners. In less than a week, our little experiment, our mock prison, receded into the background of our collective consciousness, to be replaced by a reality of prisoners, guards, and prison staff that seemed remarkably real to all. It was a prison run by psychologists rather than by the state. The detailed scrutiny that I brought to the nature of these transformations, which have never before been fully elaborated, is aimed at bringing each reader as close as possible to that special place where we can pit person power against institutional power. I tried to convey a sense of the unfolding processes by which a host of seemingly minor situational variables, such as social roles, rules, norms, and uniforms, came to have so powerful an impact on all those caught up in its system. At a conceptual level, I have proposed that we give greater consideration and more weight to situational and systemic processes than we typically do when we are trying to account for aberrant behaviors and seeming personality changes. Human behavior is always subject to situational forces. This context is embedded within a larger macrocosmic one, often a particular power system that is designed to maintain and sustain itself. Traditional analyses by most people, including those in legal, religious, and medical institutions, focus on the actor as the sole causal agent. Consequently, they minimize or disregard the impact of situational variables and systemic determinants that shape behavioral outcomes and transform actors. Hopefully, the examples and supporting information in this book will challenge the rigid fundamental attribution error that locates the inner qualities of people as the main source of their actions. We have added the need to recognize both the power of situations and the behavioral scaffolding provided by the system that crafts and upholds the social context. We have journeyed from a make-believe prison to the nightmare reality that was Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Surprising parallels emerged between the social psychological processes at work in both of those prisons, the mock one and the all-too-real one. In Abu Ghraib, our analytical spotlight focused on one young man, Staff Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick, who made a dual transformation, from good soldier to bad prison guard, and then to suffering prisoner. Our analysis revealed, just as in the Stanford prison experiment, the dispositional, situational, and systemic factors that played a crucial role in fostering the abuse and torture that Frederick and other military and civilian personnel heaped on the prisoners in their custody. I moved then from my position as an impartial social science researcher to assume the role of a prosecutor. In doing so, I exposed to you, readers as jurors, the crimes of the top brass in the military command and in the Bush administration that make them complicit in creating the conditions that in turn made possible such wide-ranging wanton abuse and torture throughout most U.S. military prisons. As noted repeatedly, the view I have provided does not negate the responsibility of these MPs, nor their guilt. Explanation and understanding do not excuse such misdeeds. Rather, understanding how the events happened and appreciating what were the situational forces operating on the soldiers can lead to proactive ways to modify the circumstances that elicit such unacceptable behavior. Punishing is not enough. Bad systems create bad situations, create bad apples, create bad behaviors, even in good people. For the last time, let's define person, situation, and system. The person is an actor on the stage of life whose behavioral freedom is informed by his or her makeup, genetic, biological, physical, and psychological. The situation is the behavioral context that has the power, through its reward and normative functions, to give meaning and identity to the actor's roles and status. The system consists of the agents and agencies whose ideology, values, and power create situations and dictate the roles and expectations for approved behaviors of actors within its spheres of influence. In this, the final phase of our journey, we will consider advice about how to prevent or combat negative situational forces that act upon all of us from time to time. We will explore how to resist influences that we neither want nor need, but that reign upon us daily. We are not slaves to the power of situational forces, but we must learn methods of resisting and opposing them. In all the situations we have explored together, there were always a few, a minority, who stood firm. The time has come to try to expand their numbers by thinking about how they were able to resist. If I have in some measure brought you to appreciate that, under some circumstances, you might behave in the ways that participants did in the research conditions outlined here and in the real prison of Abu Ghraib, I ask you to consider now, could you also accept a conception of you as a hero? We will celebrate also the good in human nature, the heroes among us, and the heroic imagination in all of us. Learning how to resist unwanted influences. People with paranoid disorders have great difficulty in conforming to, complying with, or responding to a persuasive message, even when it is offered by their well-meaning therapists or loved ones. Their cynicism and distrust create an isolating barrier that shields them from involvement in most social encounters. Because they are adamantly resistant to social pressures, they provide an extreme model for immunity to influence, though obviously at great psychic cost. At the other end of the scale are the overly gullible, unconditionally trusting people who are easy marks for any and every scam artist. Among them are the many people who fall prey to frauds, scams, and confidence games at some time in their lives. A full 12% of Americans are defrauded by con artist criminals each year, sometimes losing their life savings. It is likely that this figure is shared by people in most nations. Although the majority of those defrauded are over 50 years old, at a time of life when wisdom should prevail, many people of all ages are regularly duped by tricksters in telemarketing, healthcare, and lottery scams. Remember the phony authority hoax perpetrated on an innocent teenager at a McDonald's restaurant that was described in Chapter 12? Surely, you asked yourself, how could she and those adults duped by this caller be so stupid? Well, this same hoax was effective in getting many other fast food restaurant personnel to follow that false authority blindly. How many? Recall in a dozen different restaurant chains in nearly 70 different establishments in 32 states. We noted that one assistant manager in a McDonald's restaurant, who was totally duped by the phony caller con man, asks us all, "Unless you're in that situation at that time, how do you know what you would do? You don't know what you would do." The point is that instead of distancing ourselves from the individuals who were deceived by assuming negative dispositional attributes in them, stupidity, naivete, we need to understand why and how people like us were so completely seduced. Then we will be in a position to resist and to spread awareness of methods of resisting such hoaxes. The duality of detachment versus saturation. A basic duality exists in the human condition of detachment versus saturation, of cynical suspicion versus engagement. Detaching ourselves from others in the fear of being taken in is an extreme defensive posture, but it is true that the more open we are to other people's persuasion, the more likely we are to be swayed by them. Nevertheless, open, passionate involvement with others is essential to human happiness. We want to feel strongly, to trust completely, to act spontaneously, and to feel connected to others. We want to be fully saturated in living. At least some of the time, we want to suspend our evaluative faculties and abandon our primitive fearful reserve. We want to dance with passion along with Zorba the Greek. Yet we must regularly assess the worth of our social involvements. The challenge for each of us is how best to oscillate between two poles, immersing fully and distancing appropriately. Knowing when to stay involved with others, when to support and be loyal to a cause or a relationship rather than dismissing it, is a delicate question that we all face regularly. We live in a world in which some people aim to use us. In that same world are others who genuinely want us to share what they believe are mutually positive goals. How to tell which is which? That is the question, dear Hamlet and dear Ophelia. Before we begin to deal with specific means for combating mind-controlling influences, we must consider another possibility, the old illusion of personal invulnerability. Them? Yes. Me? No. Our psychological journey should have convinced you to appreciate how the array of situational forces that we've highlighted can suck in the majority of people. But not you, right? It is hard to extend the lessons we've learned from an intellectual assessment to affect our own codes of conduct. What is easily applied in the abstract to those others is not easily applied in the concrete to oneself. We are different. Just as no two fingerprints have identical patterns, no two people have identical genetic, developmental, and personality patterns. Individual differences should be celebrated, but in the face of strong, common situational forces, individual differences shrink and are compressed. In such instances, behavioral scientists can predict what the majority of people will do, knowing nothing about the particular people who comprise a group, only the nature of their behavioral context. It should be clear that not even the best psychology can predict how each and every individual will behave in a given situation. Some degree of individual variance always exists that cannot be accounted for. Therefore, you may reject the lessons that we are about to learn as inapplicable to yourself. You are the special case, the special end of the tail of the normal distribution. However, know that you do so at the cost of being caught with your defenses down and your tail twisted. My advice about what to do in case you encounter a dirty, rotten scoundrel disguised as a nice guy or a sweet old lady has been accumulated over many decades from many personal experiences. As a scrawny, sickly kid trying to survive on the mean streets of my South Bronx ghetto, I had to learn basic street smarts. These consisted of figuring out quickly how certain people would be likely to act in certain situations. I got good enough at the skill to become a leader of the gang, the team, or the class. Then I was trained by an unscrupulous boss, a Fagin-like character in drag, on how to deceive Broadway theatergoers into checking their hats and coats when they did not want to, and to manipulate them into paying tips to get them back when tipping was not required. As her apprentice, I became experienced in selling expensive show programs when free versions were available, and in overdosing kids with loads of candy and drinks if their parents were not chaperoning them to our candy counter. I was also trained to sell magazines door-to-door, eliciting pity from, and thereby sales to, sympathetic tenement dwellers. Later on, I studied formally the tactics police use to get confessions from suspects, that state-sanctioned torturers use to get anything they want from their victims, and that cult recruiters use in seducing the innocent into their dens. My scholarship extended to studying the mind-control tactics used by the Soviets and the methods used by the Chinese communists in the Korean War and in their massive national thought reform programs. I also studied our own homegrown mind manipulators in the CIA, the state-sponsored MK-Ultra program, and Jim Jones's lethal charismatic power over his religious followers, described in earlier chapters. I have both counseled and learned from those who survived various cult experiences. In addition, I have engaged in a lifetime of investigative research on persuasion, compliance, dissonance, and group processes. My writing on some of these topics includes a training manual for peace activists during the Vietnam War, as well as several basic texts on attitude change and social influence. These credentials are offered only to bolster the communicator credibility of the information provided next. Promoting altruism via the virtuous authority experiment. Let us first imagine a reverse Milgram authority experiment. Our goal is to create a setting in which people will comply with demands that intensify over time to do good. The participants would be guided gradually to behave in ever more altruistic ways, slowly but surely moving further than they could have imagined toward ever more positive pro-social actions. Instead of the paradigm arranged to facilitate a slow descent into evil, we could substitute a paradigm for a slow ascent into goodness. How can we formulate an experimental setting in which that was possible? Let us design such a thought experiment. To begin, imagine that we arrange for each participant a hierarchy of experiences or actions that range from slightly more positive acts than he or she is used to doing to ever more extreme good actions. The extremes of virtue push him or her upward all the way to engaging in actions that at first seemed unimaginable. There might be a time-based dimension in the design for those busy citizens who do not practice virtue because they have convinced themselves that they just don't have time to spare for good deeds. The first button on the goodness generator might be to spend 10 minutes writing a thank you note to a friend or a get-well card to a colleague. The next level might demand 20 minutes of giving advice to a troubled child. Increasing the pressure in this paradigm might then entail the participants agreeing to give 30 minutes of his time to read a story to an illiterate housekeeper. Then the altruism scale moves upward to spending an hour tutoring a needy student, then to babysitting for a few hours to allow a single parent to visit her sick mother, working for an evening in a soup kitchen, helping unemployed veterans, devoting part of a day to taking a group of orphaned children to the zoo, being able to talk with returning wounded veterans, and on upward, a step-by-step commitment to giving precious time every week to ever more worthy causes. Providing social models along the way who are already engaged in the requested task, or who take the initiative to ante up to the next level, should work to encourage obedience to virtuous authority. Should it not? It's worth a try, especially since, as far as I know, nothing like this experiment has ever been done. Ideally, our experiment in social goodness would end when the person was doing something that he or she could never have imagined doing before. Our goodness track could also include contributions to creating a healthy and sustainable environment that might go from minimal acts of conservation or recycling to ever more substantial activities, such as giving money, time, and personal involvement to green causes. I invite you to expand on this notion in a host of domains in which society would benefit as more citizens went all the way, doing good without any supporting ideology. For, as we know from dissonance theory, beliefs follow behavior. Get people to perform good actions, and they will generate the necessary underlying principles to justify them. Talmudic scholars are supposed to have preached not to require that people believe before they pray, only to do what is needed to get them to begin to pray. Then they will come to believe in what and to whom they are praying. Research supports a reverse Milgram altruism effect. As noted, this reverse Milgram experiment has never been done. Suppose we actually attempted to perform such an experiment in the laboratory, or better yet, in our homes and communities. Would it work? Could we use the power of authority and of the situation to produce virtue? Based on what I know about human beings and the principles of social influence, I'm confident that we could do a better job of bringing about righteousness in our world, employing basic principles of social influence. The reverse Milgram experiment described here combines three simple influence tactics that have been extensively studied and documented by social psychologists. The foot-in-the-door tactic, social modeling, and self-labeling of helpfulness. I've merely brought them together in one situation for promoting altruism. Moreover, researchers have found that these tactics can be used to promote all sorts of pro-social behavior, from donating one's hard-earned money to charity, to increasing recycling, and even to giving blood at the next Red Cross blood drive. Our slow ascent into goodness, step by step, makes use of what social psychologists call the foot-in-the-door, FITD, tactic. This tactic begins by first asking someone to do a small request, which most people readily perform, and then later on to ask them to comply with a related but much bigger request, which was the actual goal all along. The classic demonstration of this tactic was done more than 40 years ago by Jonathan Friedman and Scott Fraser. They asked suburbanites to put a big, ugly sign urging "drive carefully" in their nice suburban yard. Fewer than 20% of the homeowners did so. However, 3/4 of the homeowners agreed to place that sign in their yards if 2 weeks earlier they had taken a small step and posted in their windows an unobtrusive 3-inch sign urging safe driving. The same approach works with other pro-social behavior. For example, researchers have found that merely signing a petition leads to increased monetary support of the handicapped. Filling out a brief questionnaire increases the willingness of people to donate their organs to others after death. Conserving a small amount of energy induces homeowners to subsequently conserve more energy, and making a small public commitment increases the recycling of paper products. What is more, this FITD effect can be enhanced by chaining together a series of increasingly larger requests, putting 2 feet in the door, just as in our reverse Milgram experiment on promoting altruism. Our reverse Milgram experiment would also employ social models to encourage pro-social behavior. In the SPE and Abu Ghraib prison, there was an abundance of negative models that supported abusive behavior. Turning the power of social models around to enhance positive acts can be as effective in achieving the opposite desirable outcomes. Researchers have found that altruistic role models increase the likelihood that those around them will engage in positive, pro-social behavior. Here is just a sampling of findings. Social role models have been shown to increase donations to the Salvation Army, to promote helping a stranger with a flat tire, to lower rates of aggression and promote nonviolent responses, to reduce littering, and to increase donating money to poor children and a willingness to share one's resources with others. But one word of advice. Remember to practice what you preach. Models persuade far more effectively than words. For example, in one set of experiments, children were exposed to an adult model that preached either greed or charity to them in a persuasive sermon. However, that adult then went on to practice either greedy or charitable actions. The results showed that the children were more likely to do what the model did than what the model had said. The wisdom of the Talmudic scholars previously mentioned is consistent with another social influence principle underlying our reverse Milgram experiment. Give them an identity label of the kind that you would like them to have, as someone who will then do the action you want to elicit from them. When you tell a person that he or she is helpful, altruistic, and kind, that person is more likely to do helpful, altruistic, and kind behaviors for others. In the Stanford prison experiment, we randomly assigned young men to the roles of prisoner and guard, and they soon took on the manners and the behaviors of those roles. So too, if we tell someone that he or she is a helpful person, he or she will take on the manners and actions consistent with that identity label. For example, researchers have found that telling someone that he or she is a generous person increases compliance with a request to make a large contribution to prevent multiple sclerosis. Giving people feedback that they are kind makes them more likely to help someone who has dropped a large number of cards. And those given a salient identity as blood donors are more likely to continue to donate their own blood to a stranger whom they don't expect ever to know or meet. One of the great advantages of our species is the ability to explore and understand our social world and then to use what we know to make our lives better. Throughout this book, we have seen the power of the situation to produce evil. I now argue that we can take those same basic principles and use the power of the situation to produce virtue. I fear for the future of humanity if my argument on this point is a failure, or if I fail in making my argument acceptable to you. Might I suggest that you take a small step today in carrying out the reverse Milgram experiment in your own life? I think you are just the person to do it, and to serve as a role model for others in transforming our world to one with a more positive future. If not you, then who? A 10-step program to resist unwanted influences. If we consider some of the social psychological principles that fostered the evils we saw during the course of our journey, then once again, as we have just done in constructing the goodness generator example, let us use variants of those principles to get people to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative in their lives. Given the range of different types of influence, it would be necessary to tailor resistance to each type. Combating wrong, dissonant commitments requires different tactics from opposing compliance-gaining strategies used on us. Confronting persuasive speeches and powerful communicators forces us to use different principles than we need for dealing with those who would dehumanize us or de-individuate us. Ways of undercutting groupthink are also different from ways of modifying the impact of intense recruiters. I have developed such a compendium for you. However, it offers more depth and specifics than is possible to deal with in this chapter. The solution is to make it all available to you free, online, in the special website developed as a companion to this book, www.lucifereffect.com. That way, you can read it at your leisure, take notes, check out the reference sources on which it is based, and contemplate scenarios in which you will put these resistance strategies into practice in your life. Also, after you have encountered a particular social influence tactic used on you or on others you know, you can turn to this handy guide for solutions about what to do next time around to be in a better position to master that challenge. Here is my 10-step program for resisting the impact of undesirable social influences and at the same time promoting personal resilience and civic virtue. It uses ideas that cut across various influence strategies and provides simple, effective modes of dealing with them. The key to resistance lies in development of the three S's: self-awareness, situational sensitivity, and street smarts. You will see how they are central to many of these general strategies of resistance. I made a mistake. Let's start out by encouraging admission of our mistakes, first to ourselves, then to others. Accept the dictum that to err is human. You have made an error in judgment. Your decision was wrong. You had every reason to believe it was right when you made it, but now you know you were wrong. Say the six magic words: I'm sorry, I apologize, forgive me. Say to yourself that you will learn from your mistakes, grow better from them. Don't continue to put your money, time, and resources into bad investments. Move on. Doing so openly reduces the need to justify or rationalize our mistakes, and thereby to continue to give support to bad or immoral actions. Confession of error undercuts the motivation to reduce cognitive dissonance. Dissonance evaporates when a reality check occurs. Cutting bait instead of resolutely staying the course when it is wrong has an immediate cost, but it always results in long-term gain. Consider how many years the Vietnam War continued long after top military and administration officials, such as Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, knew that the war was wrong and could not be won. How many thousands of lives were lost to such wrong-headed resistance when acknowledging failure and error could have saved them? How much good could come to all of us were our political leaders able to admit their similar errors in Iraq? It is more than a political decision to save face by denying errors instead of saving soldiers and civilian lives. It is a moral imperative. I am mindful. In many settings, smart people do dumb things because they fail to attend to key features in the words or actions of influence agents and fail to notice obvious situational clues. Too often we function on automatic pilot, using outworn scripts that have worked for us in the past, never stopping to evaluate whether they are appropriate in the here and now. Following the advice of the Harvard researcher Ellen Langer, we must transform our usual state of mindless inattention into mindfulness, especially in new situations. Don't hesitate to fire a wake-up shot to your cortex. When we are in familiar situations, old habits continue to rule even though they have become obsolete or wrong. We need to be reminded not to live our lives on automatic pilot, but always to take a Zen moment to reflect on the meaning of the immediate situation, to think before acting. Never go mindlessly into situations where angels and sensible people fear to tread. For the best results, add critical thinking to mindfulness in your resistance. Ask for evidence to support assertions. Demand that ideologies be sufficiently elaborated to allow you to separate rhetoric from substance. Try to determine whether the recommended means ever justify potentially harmful ends. Imagine endgame scenarios of the future consequences of any current practice. Support critical thinking from the earliest times in children's lives, alerting them to the deceptive TV ads, biased claims, and distorted perspectives being presented to them. Help them become wiser and warier knowledge consumers. I am responsible. Taking responsibility for one's decisions and actions puts the actor in the driver's seat, for better or for worse. Allowing others to compromise their own responsibility to diffuse it makes them powerful backseat drivers and makes the car move recklessly ahead without a responsible driver. We become more resistant to undesirable social influence by always maintaining a sense of personal responsibility and being willing to be held accountable for our actions. Obedience to authority is less blind to the extent that we are aware that diffusion of responsibility merely disguises our individual complicity in the conduct of questionable actions. Your conformity to antisocial group norms is undercut to the extent that you do not allow displacement of responsibility when you refuse to spread responsibility around the gang, the frat, the shop, the battalion, or the corporation. Always imagine a future time when today's deed will be on trial, and no one will accept your pleas of only following orders or everyone else was doing it. I will assert my unique identity. Do not allow others to de-individuate you, to put you into a category, a box, a slot, to turn you into an object. Assert your individuality. Politely state your name and your credentials, loud and clear. Insist on the same behavior in others. Make eye contact. Remove all eye-concealing sunglasses. And offer information about yourself that reinforces your unique identity. Find common ground with dominant others in influence situations and use it to enhance similarities. Anonymity and secrecy conceal wrongdoing and undermine the human connection. They can become the breeding grounds that generate dehumanization. And, as we now know, Dehumanization provides the killing ground for bullies, rapists, torturers, terrorists, and tyrants. Go a step beyond self-individuation. Work to change whatever social conditions make people feel anonymous. Instead, support practices that make others feel special, so that they too have a sense of personal value and self-worth. Never allow or practice negative stereotyping. Words, labels, and jokes can be destructive if they mock others. I respect just authority, but rebel against unjust authority. In every situation, work to distinguish between those in authority who, because of their expertise, wisdom, seniority, or special status, deserve respect, and the unjust authority figures who demand our obedience without having any substance. Many who assume the mantle of authority are pseudo-leaders, false prophets, confidence men and women, self-promoters who should not be respected, but rather disobeyed and openly exposed to critical evaluation. Parents, teachers, and religious leaders should play more active roles in teaching children this critical differentiation. They should be polite and courteous when such a stance is justified, yet be good, wise children by resisting those authorities who do not deserve their respect. Doing so will reduce our mindless obedience to self-proclaimed authorities whose priorities are not in our best interests. I want group acceptance, but value my independence. The lure of acceptance into a desired social group is more powerful than that of the mythical golden ring in Lord of the Rings. The power of that desire for acceptance will make some people do almost anything to be accepted, and go to even further extremes to avoid rejection by the group. We are indeed social animals, and usually our social connections benefit us and help us to achieve important goals that we could not achieve alone. However, there are times when conformity to a group norm is counterproductive to the social good. It is imperative to determine when to follow the norm and when to reject it. Ultimately, we live within our own minds in solitary splendor, and therefore we must be willing and ready to declare our independence regardless of the social rejection it may elicit. It is not easy, especially for young people with a shaky self-image or adults whose self-image is isomorphic with that of their job. Pressures on them to be a team player, to sacrifice personal morality for the good of the team, are nearly irresistible. What is required is that we step back, get outside opinions, and find new groups that will support our independence and promote our values. There will always be another, different, better group for us. I will be more frame vigilant. Who makes the frame becomes the artist, or the con artist. The way issues are framed is often more influential than the persuasive arguments within their boundaries. Moreover, effective frames can seem not to be frames at all, just sound bites, visual images, slogans, and logos. They influence us without our being conscious of them, and they shape our orientation toward the ideas or issues they promote. For example, voters who favored reducing estate tax benefits for the rich were urged to vote against a death tax. The tax was exactly the same, but its defining term was different. We desire things that are framed as being scarce, even when they are plentiful. We are averse to things that are framed as potential losses and prefer what is presented to us as a gain, even when the ratio of positive to negative prognoses is the same. We don't want a 40% chance of losing X over Y, but we do want the 60% chance of gaining Y over X. The linguist George Lakoff clearly shows in his writings that it is crucial to be aware of frame power and to be vigilant in order to offset its insidious influence on our emotions, thoughts, and votes. I will balance my time perspective. We can be led to do things that are not really what we believe in when we allow ourselves to become trapped in an expanded present moment. When we stop relying on our sense of past commitments and our sense of future liabilities, we open ourselves to situational temptations to engage in Lord of the Flies excesses. By not going with the flow when others around you are being abusive or out of control, you are relying on a temporal perspective that stretches beyond present-oriented hedonism or present-oriented fatalism. You're likely to engage in a cost-benefit analysis of your actions in terms of their future consequences. Or you may resist by being sufficiently conscious of a past time frame that contains your personal values and standards. By developing a balanced time perspective in which past, present, and future can be called into action, depending on the situation and task at hand, you will be in a better position to act responsibly and wisely than when your time perspective is biased toward reliance on only one or two time frames. Situational power is weakened when past and future combine to contain the excesses of the present. For example, research indicates that righteous Gentiles who helped to hide Dutch Jews from the Nazis did not engage in the kind of rationalizing their neighbors did in generating reasons for not helping. These heroes depended upon moral structures derived from their past, and never lost sight of a future time when they would look back on this terrible situation and be forced to ask themselves whether they had done the right thing when they chose not to succumb to fear and social pressure. I will not sacrifice personal or civic freedoms for the illusion of security. The need for security is a powerful determinant of human behavior. We can be manipulated into engaging in actions that are alien to us when faced with alleged threats to our security or the promise of security from danger. More often than not, influence peddlers gain power over us by offering a Faustian contract. You will be safe from harm if you will just surrender some of your freedom, either personal or civic, to that authority. The Mephistophelian tempter will argue that his power to save you depends upon all the people making small sacrifices of this little right or that small freedom. Reject that deal. Never sacrifice basic personal freedoms for the promise of security, because the sacrifices are real and immediate, and the security is a distant illusion. This is as true in traditional marital arrangements as it is in the commitment of good citizens to the interests of their nation when its leader promises personal safety and national security at the cost of a collective sacrifice of suspending laws, privacy, and freedoms. Erich Fromm's classic Escape from Freedom reminds us that this is the first step a fascist leader takes, even in a nominally democratic society. I can oppose unjust systems. Individuals falter in the face of the intensity of the systems we have described, the military and prison systems, as well as those of gangs, cults, fraternities, corporations, and even dysfunctional families. But individual resistance in concert with that of others of the same mind and resolve can combine to make a difference. The next section in this chapter will portray individuals who changed systems by being willing to take the risk of blowing the whistle on corruption within them or by constructively working to change them. Resistance may involve physically removing oneself from a total situation in which all information, rewards, and punishments are controlled. It may involve challenging the groupthink mentality and being able to document all allegations of wrongdoing. It may involve getting help from other authorities, counselors, investigative reporters, or revolutionary compatriots. Systems have enormous power to resist change and withstand even righteous assault. Here is one place where individual acts of heroism to challenge unjust systems and their bad barrel makers are best performed by soliciting others to join one's cause. The system can redefine individual opposition as delusional, a pair of opponents as sharing a folie à deux, but with three on your side, you become a force of ideas to be reckoned with. This 10-step program is really only a starter kit toward building individual resistance and communal resilience against undesirable influences and illegitimate attempts at persuasion. As mentioned, a fuller set of recommendations and relevant research-based references can be found on the Lucifer Effect website under Resisting Influence Guide. Before moving to the final stop in our journey, celebrating heroes and heroism, I would like to add two final general recommendations. First, be discouraged from venial sins and small transgressions, such as cheating, lying, gossiping, spreading rumors, laughing at racist or sexist jokes, teasing, and bullying. They can become stepping stones to more serious falls from grace. They serve as many facilitators for thinking and acting destructively against your fellow creatures. Second, moderate your in-group biases. That means accepting that your group is special, but at the same time respecting the diversity that other groups offer. Fully appreciate the wonder of human variety and its variability. Assuming such a perspective will help you to reduce group biases that lead to derogating others, to prejudice and stereotyping, and to the evils of dehumanization. The Paradoxes of Heroism. A young woman challenges an authority older than she, forcing him to recognize his complicity in reprehensible deeds that are being perpetrated on his watch. Her confrontation goes further and helps to terminate the abuse of innocent prisoners by their guards. Does her action qualify as heroic, given that scores of others who had witnessed their prisoners' distress all failed to act against the system when they realized its excesses? We would like to celebrate heroism and heroes as special acts by special people. However, most people who are held up to this higher plane insist that what they did was not special, was really what everyone should have done in that situation. They refuse to consider themselves heroes. Maybe such a reaction comes from the ingrained notion we all have that heroes are supermen and women, a cut or more above the common breed. Perhaps more than their modesty is at work. Perhaps rather it is our general misconception of what it takes to be heroic. Let's now look at the best in human nature and the transformation of the ordinary into the heroic. We will examine alternative conceptions and definitions of heroism and propose a way to classify different kinds of heroic action. Then elaborate on some examples that fall into these categories. And finally design a table of contrasts between the banalities of evil and of heroism. But first, let's go back to the person and the act that started this section and ended the Stanford prison experiment. Recall from Chapter 8 that Christina Maslach was a recently graduated Ph.D. from the Stanford Psychology Department with whom I had become romantically involved. When she saw a chain gang of prisoners being carted to the toilet with bags over their heads, as guards shouted orders at them, and she witnessed my apparent indifference to their suffering, she exploded. Her later account of what she felt at the time and how she interpreted her actions tells us a good deal about the complex phenomenon of heroism. What he, Zimbardo, got was an incredibly emotional outburst from me. I am usually a rather contained person. I was angry and frightened and in tears. I said something like, "What you are doing to those boys is a terrible thing." So what is the important story to emerge from my role as the terminator of the Stanford prison experiment? I think there are several themes I would like to highlight. First, however, let me say what the story is not. Contrary to the standard and trite American myth, the Stanford prison experiment is not a story about the lone individual who defies the majority. Rather, it is a story about the majority, about how everyone who had some contact with the prison study, participants, researchers, observers, consultants, family, and friends, got so completely sucked into it. The power of the situation to overwhelm personality and the best of intentions is the key storyline here. So why was my reaction so different? The answer, I think, lies in two facts. I was a late entrant into the situation, and I was an outsider. Unlike everyone else, I had not been a consenting participant in the study. Unlike everyone else, I had no socially defined role within that prison context. Unlike everyone else, I was not there every day, being carried along as the situation changed and escalated bit by bit. Thus, the situation I entered at the end of the week was not truly the same as it was for everyone else. I lacked their proper consensual history, place, and perspective. For them, the situation was construed as being still within the range of normalcy. For me, it was not. It was a madhouse. As an outsider, I did not have the option of specific social rules that I could disobey, so my dissent took a different form, of challenging the situation itself. This challenge has been seen by some as a heroic action, but at the time it did not feel especially heroic. To the contrary, it was a very scary and lonely experience being the deviant, doubting my judgment of both situations and people, and maybe even my worth as a research social psychologist. Christina then raises a profound qualification. For an act of personal defiance to be worthy of being considered heroic, it must attempt to change the system, to correct an injustice, to right a wrong. I had to consider also in the back of my mind what I might do if Phil continued with the SPE, despite my determined challenge to him.